It is 2020 and welcome to the first of my nostalgia interviews of the new decade. Timothy Britton Catlin is an architect and my first guest of the new year. Timothy is reader in the Kent School of Architecture, and we begin by talking about buildings which elude even architects, why some of us are more image-based and others function using words. We find out what Timothy's views are on the sat-nav. It's the work of the devil, he tells us. Timothy talks about growing up just within the boundaries of inner London. We talk about rebuilding the past, why he has a very vivid memory when it comes to buildings. He reveals how one theme that does tend to repeat in his dreams is that of going back somewhere he once lived and wanting to go back there, and how this underlies all his work on architecture. We talk about dreams more generally. We find out that his mother was a public relations executive. The family moved to Scotland. We talk about how he had a voice coach during his time in Israel, where he spent most of the 1990s, and how image is conveyed through accents. We talk about the power of music, including Morning Town Ride, the Junior Choice theme, by the Seekers, and listening to the Radio 3 Midnight News, one of a very small number of people who would do that back in the 1980s. We talk about why architects don't tend to be word people. We talk about the eligibility of submitting a building rather than an article for the University Research Excellence Framework. We discuss how architectural critiques come from personal experience, how memories can be falsely remembered. Timothy asks me whether we can only be nostalgic about shared experiences rather than individual ones. We move on to the notion of correcting the past in the context of architecture, and about the fit or lack of between architecture and academia and the Protestant work ethic. We talk about his family's religious heritage, and we talk about politics because Timothy's aunt is Baroness Shirley Williams, one of the original Gang of Four, a Liberal Democrat peer. We talk about his experience of meeting politicians and why he could never himself have become a politician. I asked Timothy whether his aunt would have wanted to be leader of the opposition had she won Stevenage in 1979, and we discuss how Tony Blair was in some respects to the right of the SDP. Towards the end of the interview, Timothy reveals why he doesn't look back at anything too inquisitively. He tells us what is the only message worth giving. And we talk about the disparity sometimes in teaching quality between school and university, and why the style with which one writes doesn't reflect one's personality, and how writing is a technical skill. It was an immense privilege to catch up with Timothy Britton Catlin for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure this afternoon to have Timothy Britton Catlin here from the School of Architecture.
Thank you, Chris. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. And we were just saying before we started that originally I thought, how do I let you know, Timothy, how to get to the office? And I thought, you know, as an architect, you probably have a better sense than certainly I do of how to get from A to B on this campus, or maybe not.
If you are an architect, you can generally find the loos. Yeah. That's the main practical advantage. Very few buildings defeat architects completely, but the interior of the Barbican Art Centre is one, and Elliott College here, where my own office is another one.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I first came to Kent in 2004, I was always aware that there were particular buildings that I had to go to every week, but the journey to the room and back from the room afterwards, they never followed the same route each week. And, you know, sometimes I think, I'm sure this is a student part of the building, or there's a restaurant here, or there's a cafe here, or a corridor that just sort of goes nowhere. But somehow I managed to get there and back every week, but I could never remember the route.
There is a theme in architectural criticism that this is intentional, that the architect here is in control and taking you around their building the way they want you to see it.
Yeah. Now that's an interesting question, because I guess it raises a wider set of questions about somebody's state of mind or what they're trying to do or the ideology. And of course it's unique to them. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's sort of the way they were thinking at a particular time, or this was the way in which they conceived of the space in which they're inhabiting. Is that something that is sort of deliberate on the part of architects?
Architects do have a strange attitude to buildings, as you'd expect. It's not a normal attitude in any way, and it does actually tend to emphasise the technical and the small scale, whilst the big scale picture is going on at the back of their minds. So architects certainly see pictures in different ways. It's certainly buildings in different ways, but it's certainly struck me as extraordinary when I realised quite late in life that many people, perhaps even most people, can't read plans, in fact, or sections or elevations. And one of the most useful pieces of advice I ever had came to me from a third-year dissertation student who was himself an expert designer. And he said the problem is that architects try to convey things through images when, in fact, most people understand them through words. He was talking about a scheme in Chatham. A world-famous architect, whose name for the moment escapes me, had designed the waterfront and presented it to the residents with glorious images, renders, perspectives, views, and so on. And the local residents who were to be affected by this were absolutely outraged and appalled by the whole thing, to the architect's astonishment. And what this chap, his name was Adam Summerfield, what he said, which was so right, was that what the architects needed to do was to tell a story about what it was that they wanted to do and to refer to places where they had been, where maybe people locally had been, not necessarily particularly exotic places, but places in England or elsewhere that have a resonance to them, or stories out of the whole history of literature, which are easily memorable, and tell their new scheme in those terms. This is absolutely right, I think. I think Adam got it right. I think it was a brilliant thing to say, and it had a lot of effect on the way in which I saw the critique of buildings afterwards.
Yeah, and I was very aware as well that even just going around this campus, you know, the way sometimes that if you're particularly wordy, as I tend to be, you know, I'm not very good at maps. As a student, I used to see other students writing down the notes from the lecture that they were attending and using all sorts of diagrams and maps and things pointing here and there. That meant nothing to me. I'd have to sort of try and get as verbatim as possible the words of the tutor. So we all sort of, you know, function in different ways. But the number of people who, myself included, sometimes just get really stumped.
I've been wondering now how when I was a teenager, yeah, I used to go off and see buildings I'd read about, mainly at that time Edwardian buildings. And I wonder now how I found them. I'm thinking of one in particular, which is outside Groombridge on the border between Sussex and Kent, which really is in the middle of nowhere. I looked it up recently. And yet I do remember being there and finding the place without any difficulty. Yeah. What I think I must have done was to go into the Marsham Street Public Library and got out the one-inch Ordnance Survey map and then just learnt it. I had a very good photographic memory for a long time. I may have written some notes, turn left and then right or something like that. But certainly I was used to looking at maps and learning from them at a very young age. I was my party trick in some areas of town planning was to be able to identify where a photograph had been taken from the map. And in fact, when I thought I was going to be enlisted into the Israeli army, that's the part of it that I wanted to get into, because I would have enjoyed that, I think. Yeah. It's very gratifying, by the way. You get a blurry picture of the back of something and you can track it down on an Ordnance Survey map, and then it really makes your day if you can do that.
Absolutely, because I think if ever I'm a passenger, I tend to be very passive. I don't really, you know, I can do the same route every day, but somebody will say, you know, do we turn left or right here? And I don't know. But if I'm driving, I seem to have an innate sense of how to get from A to B. And I've sometimes gone to places other end of the country without using a sat-nav or any apps on my phone, and I seem to be able to do it. There's something instinctive there.
I think that sat-navs are the work of the devil, and this is what I tell the students as well. But I think it is because most people can't understand maps, in fact. It always amazes me that there are architects who have sat-navs that's... Yeah. And I can understand having a screen on your dashboard, but a person talking is just astonishing, it seems to me, when you should be able to read it off the map.
But so I've given away that I've been at Kent for 15 years, and I get the sense that you've been here a similar sort of length
slightly
of time.
Less. I came in the autumn of 2007.
And where were you before that?
I was mostly teaching at the Architectural Association School of Architecture in Bedford Square in London. I was doing, as one does in the early curacy days, as it were, I was teaching at New York University in London, which is on the other side of Bedford Square from the AA, and also at Cambridge at that point.
One of the things that I always find really fascinating in doing these interviews is you know, is the trip down to childhood and what people's earliest memories are. And of course, you come from a very illustrious family, as no doubt will come out. But are there particular things from childhood that stand out?
Oh, the places. Yeah, absolutely. The places went in really deep. Yeah. Now, I was born, I can just about say that I come from inner London, because like many people in West London, I was born in Queen Charlotte's Hospital, which is half a road in from the old London County Council boundary. So that's inner London and just. And we lived in a house on Brook Green in Hammersmith, up the road from Hammersmith Underground Station. And that environment had a profound effect on me, to the extent that when I imagine it now, and I have been there for one reason or another quite a lot, also to do with my work, I imagine it always looking like it did then, and it's a surprise that it doesn't anymore. So that's the first one. My older brother said something the other day when I realised quite how right he was, and it hadn't occurred to me till he said it. We had a holiday flat in Kingsgate Castle between Broadstairs and Margate. Now, the story of that was that it was a Georgian folly. It was turned into a large house for Lord Avebury from about 1901 onwards, and then it became a fancy hotel. And then after the Second World War, the hotel suites were, they joined two to make one tiny flat, and they were tiny and cheap flats. And we lived in one of them. And my brother said to me the other day, talking to my sister-in-law, I think he was saying, Kingsgate Castle had a tremendous effect, on me. And, of course, it's true. The work that I've just completed, which is a project about Edwardian domestic architecture, starts at Kingsgate Castle. And I tracked down the architectural development of that building in as much detail as I possibly could, including the flat layouts when it was made into flats in the 1950s. So there is a long theme of going back somewhere and wanting it to be like it always was. And I hadn't realised till I thought about it consciously quite how much that colours everything that I write.
And in terms of nostalgia, when I started on the research on this about 3-4 years ago, I was very conscious of the binaries that you often see in the literature between nostalgia as place, rebuilding a place that once was, that may not be there now, but you want to rebuild, and time. So I suppose place and space sort of come into this, but this sense of you're longing for the time, or you're longing for the actual people, or you're longing for the actual buildings, the architecture of the past, or a combination of the two, of course. But it sounds very much as though particular buildings that you associate with periods from your childhood are very much something that today you kind of see as a go-to point.
This is why it's essentially a tragic thing, isn't it? Because you can't remake the period, even if you can remake the building. The first time that I was perhaps most conscious of what I was doing was what happened to the Commonwealth Institute on Kensington High Street. Now, I don't know if you remember that. It's in there somewhere in a terrible mashed up way now. Yeah. It was a hyperbolic paraboloid of the late 1950s. It was an exhibition building, essentially, set in a public park designed by Sylvia Crowe, a very distinguished landscape architect, and on part of what had been Holland Park, and it was straight onto Kensington High Street. And it was about halfway between where we lived and where one set of grandparents lived, nearer to them, I suppose. But it was certainly near enough to go there regularly, and we went there regularly from school. Now, that building had a somewhat sad afterlife. What happened to it was that to cut that story short, the government wanted to sell the land, because a piece of land sitting on Kensington High Street was worth an enormous amount of money by now. And what they had sitting on it was a protected building. It was a Grade 2 star listed building, let's say a building of national importance, was sitting there falling to bits, essentially, or so they said. Not, it wasn't, in fact, quite as much as they said, but that was what was claimed. So there was a tasteless battle in which Her Majesty's Secretary of State tried to make the argument that if the Foreign and Commonwealth Office could not sell the land, then they would have to cut the aid budget. That's to say, if you want to keep this building, then you're going to kill small children in Africa. That was about the line of it. It was very nasty business. What happened in the end was that the building was strangely refurbished as the design museum, but where Sylvia Crowe's garden had been were three blocks of expensive flats, I think still probably empty, although they finished some time ago. And this whole story made me enormously angry at the time, and continued to do so, continues to do so. I think it is was really shocking, actually. One of the things that it did was that it was a genuinely public space that genuinely brought people together in an, what has become an unbelievably expensive part of London. My parents married in 1951, and even then, they were both born in Kensington. In fact, my mum was born about 200 yards east of the Commonwealth Institute and my father about 200 yards south of it. So they're both from round there, but even by 1951 they couldn't afford to live there, which is how we came to be in Hammersmith. So here is this very expensive area, and there was a genuine public amenity of a very high standard, a very sort of public-spirited undertaking, the whole thing, just turned into another set of expensive flats. It was an awful thing, I realised. And what you want is not just for the building to resort. You want to be back then, don't you? Yeah. You want to be back queuing in the rain, as I would have been in 1967 or something, to go into it. For some reason, in the refurbishment, they have destroyed the original entrance route, which was a genuinely magical thing. You went down a kind of, a colonnaded route, and you arrived at a little pond which you crossed on a bridge, and then into a darkened area with stained glass windows, and through a dark area, and then you found yourself in the middle of this extraordinary space.
You have a very vivid memory.
Oh,
of
yes,
that. So
absolutely.
Where does that, is that because
never
you have
forget
a
it. I remember
memory,
the music.
Or, yeah, is it no. because you, I mean, as I was saying to you before we started recording, I always kept a diary, but where does that image come from? Is it just because you have a particular kind of memory, or do you have detailed notes from that period?
No, I remember it. I don't, my memory is terrible, by the way. I couldn't remember what I find it hard to remember what I did yesterday.
Yeah.
It is atrocious. When we were speaking earlier, I said that I have a friend who keeps a diary, and he remembers without the use of his diary exactly on what day I said what. I wouldn't remember it as much as 10 days ago. But buildings, I remember very vividly. I'll tell you something else that struck me, Chris, is that I'm interested in hearing what when people have dreams that repeat, right? Now, I don't, in fact, tend to have dreams that repeat very much or dreams of any distinction whatsoever, but there is one theme that does repeat, and it probably occurs about every 5 years or so, not more than that, and it's always the same thing, which is always going back to somewhere where I was, where I had lived, and wanting to live there again.
Yeah.
And that reappears all the time. As I say, it took quite a long time till I realised how much this sat at the bottom of everything that I write about architecture and how I see it.
Yeah. It is funny how sometimes there are particular, you know, dreams, as you say, involving people, in some cases people that you've never met, and it might be people who represent things that don't seem to have anything to do with your sort of daily life. It might be a football player or a pop star or TV presenter. And you think, you know, why am I dreaming about these people? And I think and I've put it down to this notion of counterpoint, that sometimes, you know, if you're sitting in an office, if you're doing a lot of research and you sort of work in a certain way, there's another part of you that almost needs something very diametrically opposite to that in order to be able to sort of almost give you some sense of perspective and proportion. So you're doing something in your dreams that you're not doing in daily
life.
Well,
I read, in the course of my Edwardian research, I came across a writer called Frederick Greenwood, who wrote a book that sold very well at the time called Imagination in Dreams. And his idea about what dreams were was your brain trying to make sense of irrational things and reaching out for possible connections or sources. Now, that seems to me to be fairly likely. I like this suggestion that you're attempting to rationalise the irrational. So you're doing it when you are not conscious. So you're not organising it. It's just kind of falling into place in ways that your brain can understand it. Yeah. That would seem to me to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I run a module called Death in the Afterlife, where we look at a particular parapsychologist who was a philosopher and somebody who worked with the paranormal, and he called H.H. Price, and he put forward the idea that when we dream, or the fact that we dream in a way that we don't have to be in a physical place, but we dream about physical objects, is akin to the afterlife. So he was saying that in the afterlife, you don't have to say, where is heaven? Because it can be a state of mind or a dreamlike existence. Wonderful analogy. And in a way, he's not necessarily the most representative figure, but I thought there's no way I'm not going to have him on my module, because the students are often sort of aghast when they hear this, because everybody dreams and everybody wonders what their dreams mean. And suddenly somebody's saying those dreams might give you some a foretaste, maybe,
yes,
of really ultimately who we are
of something and how we define ourselves. Yes, yeah. That's right.
But what about, we touched on childhood a little bit, but we didn't, what your parents did. So you mentioned that they got married in 1951. What did your parents do?
Yeah, my mum was a public relations executive. She was in advertising round about the time that I was born. My father had more or less disappeared by the time I was five or six. We moved to Scotland when my mother remarried in 1970, was it? 71, somewhere around there. 71, I think. So that's what it was. And I had two brothers. I had subsequently two sisters. Yeah. So the total of us was five by the time we'd been in Scotland a few years.
And it's interesting you mentioned Scotland, because I'm from Wales originally, but have no traces of a Welsh accent. And that's another thing that I always find because sometimes somebody will speak in a certain way, says something very much about, you know, where they're from, their background, their particular life circumstances. But I always find it interesting listening back to myself, and also a number of the people I've interviewed as well, and just find that sometimes you can't work out necessarily from somebody's accent, if they have one at all, what their past is. Of course, there's that element of intrigue that, you know, somebody could have. You mentioned the Israeli army
yes.
at one point.
I think what people can do with accents is fascinating. When I was in Israel, I had elocution lessons, so that I would sound like a newsreader. I know many people who have adopted native, what sound like native accents when they've moved country, but it's because they really wanted to do it. Whereas I always felt slightly fraudulent doing it, but I did switch it on for planning committees and for teaching, actually. Mm. So I did do it. And I remember saying to the voice coach, who was the voice coach of the Israeli National Theatre, what I want is a slightly Iraqi accent, because that's what my family were. And she was horrified by this suggestion, so she wouldn't do it. So I spoke the equivalent of RP, probably. But I do like very much the idea of the how image is conveyed through accents. I went to the one day's filming of Testament of Youth, which was the film of my grandmother's book made a few years back. And I met there the voice coach who had been employed to assist the lead actress, who was Swedish. She had complete control of every possible sound. And she was telling me that she'd been the voice coach for a film. It was called something like that, that was about Etonians at Oxford, I think it was about, and it had somebody from Westminster School in it. And she had to give them the correct accents. And I said to her, can you tell from my accent that I am from Westminster School? And what she then did was that she then spoke back to me precisely in my own voice, as if I'd said it, completely spot on. She had so complete an ear and so complete a control, Penny Dyer she's called, that she could just make it change. I heard another voice coach on the cinema voice coach on the radio a couple of weeks back who did it again, who every time she mentioned a place she could go completely into it. And these things I also thought that I quite liked the fact that the Israeli students whom I was teaching, we could see that they were slightly puzzled by the fact that somebody whose body language was so completely British could come out sounding like a newsreader.
And how did you end up in Israel? Was that part of your work?
No, I went there for work because I was bored of work in England. It wasn't that. It was fairly miserable being in London at the end of the 1980s. So I went off for 10 years, the whole of the 1990s, which means I don't know about anything that happened in Britain during the 1990s. I came across once a year. For in those days, in order to teach, you had to have slides of buildings, and I would come over once a year and manically take lots of photographs and hope that the film had wound through the camera properly, as sometimes it didn't. But that was it. So I know nothing about Britain.
No, it's funny you said, because I remember reading Peter Mandelson's autobiography, The Third Man, but as it happened, I saw the Carol Reed film, Third Man, yesterday. But it was fascinating because he spent a number of years in Europe as a European commissioner. And what was so fascinating is that in his book, he wasn't obviously at the centre of events between Blair and Brown, but reading the story, you know, he knows that people reading this are going to be more interested in the political struggle at Westminster than over in Brussels. So even though he was in Brussels all these years, he's writing as if he had, you know, first-hand accounts of, you know, Blair would ring him when all the rest of it, all this was going on. So he's writing as if he really was in the room, but we know that he was in Brussels. So, of course, so it's funny what you say there about not knowing what was going on, because some people, of course, would have a different sort of apprehension of, you know, you the expat, I sort of, you know, notion of, you know, you're out of your country, but you have a very, I feel more Welsh in Canterbury than I do in Wales, because I don't sound very Welsh in Wales. I feel like an imposter, even though I'm from Cardiff, this is how I speak. But as soon as I meet a Welsh student, and I have quite a few, I get very excited, because it's a sort of, I feel more, maybe it's nostalgia for my heritage. I'm not a very nationalistic person, but I do feel proud to be Welsh when I'm not in Wales and I come into contact with somebody who is from the same part of the world.
My own heritage is too mixed for me to feel proud of it as such. It's so complicated that there isn't any identifiable heritage identity in that sense. It doesn't bother me. It's a fact of life, isn't it? You can't do anything about it, so you live with it.
Absolutely.
Forget it, or talk about something else.
But one thing that, when I was growing up, was music. I mean, to the point of obsession, and this is something that comes up in all of the interviews. I mean, for me, it was often, you know, the stuff that was in the charts at the time. It was you know, very specific, but which has never left me. It feels like it's in my DNA. It's the sort of stuff, you know, I think, same with accents in a way. If you have an accent when you're very young, you can lose it. If, you know, if you can speak in a very strong Welsh accent at the age of four, but, you know, you're not going to have that if you move somewhere in England, you know, at the age of 10 or 11. But music, it's ingrained in me in the same way that, and it's quality proof as well, that the sort of stuff, no matter how awful it might sound, how kitsch it might be, it's part of my growing up, and I associate, you know, particular school or university events with that particular period. Do you have anything like that in your context?
Well, first of all, I would say about music, that I have a feeling that music is one of those areas where we really know nothing about what its power is and what its fate is. It clearly is something that's completely distinct from anything else. I remember seeing a long time ago now, it must have been, a television programme about someone who had been a conductor who lost his memory completely. But when he was conducting, he was completely recovered, and only then. It was made some impact on me, I think. So there is a lot going on there that we don't know. Yes, I do remember the music of the 60s and the 70s, and I liked it. I liked the music of the late 60s. I was speaking just earlier this week to an Australian friend about the Seekers, Morningtown Rite, and so on. Yeah. Why do those things have such an impact on me? And then I was born in 1961. Why do those things have such an extraordinary impact? There was a sense, I think, probably even for children in the late 60s, that things were changing fast in an exciting way. Obviously, the moon landing, I think, probably had more impact than anything else. People talked about nothing else for quite a long time, and quite justifiably so. But there was certainly a sense of all that stuff, all the Sandy Shaw era. My brother is quite a bit older than me. So he was from he's 8 years older than me. So in Beatles era, he was at record buying age where I wasn't, but that means that we had them all and we heard them all. So certainly that made quite a bit of impact, and so did the music of the early 70s, though I don't know if it's in quite the same way. I was a great Peter Skellen fan. That was the kind of
thing. Oh, you're a lady.
Yes. Yes, well, all those things. And I realised that one of the things I like about that, there are different types of music that made an impression on me, and I quite liked the hugely camp thing of the wild over orchestrations that you also can get in some 60s music, where the whole thing is, the whole presentation of a song is enormously over the top, which has very good effect. The Pet Shop Boys do it a bit, and I always like that as well, that it's too much, really, the choirs of thousands singing away for somebody's minor panic. I think that's terribly funny. There are some other television things. There are very few people who of my age who can hear, for example, the theme music of the Robinson Crusoe television series, right, with a dry eye. Why it has that impact, I've no idea whatsoever. I'm not, in fact, I don't much go... make much effort to listen to music. There are some things that I'm quite happy to hear over and over again. When I was in Israel, I listened to the equivalent of Radio 3. It was very much the equivalent of Radio 3 because the Israeli Radio Corporation had been set up with advice from the BBC, and it reflected its structure in many ways, and it had a proper classical music station. It didn't, unfortunately, by the 1990s, have on it dramas in the way that Radio 3 does now. But what it did have was it must have had a tiny audience. I remember my brother saying a long time back that the number of people who listened to the Radio 3 Midnight News, as I did in the 1980s, was so tiny that it would have been cheaper for the BBC to ring up everyone and tell them. And if that's the case, then they must have been down to double figures, I should think, probably the Israeli one with a tenth of the population of Israel, or several hundred probably at most. So I did tend to have to listen to things then, and some things stuck in my mind, but it's never been really an enormously motivating factor unless it is attached to something else, and then it does.
Yeah.
So if it is music that's attached to, not, I don't mean film music exactly, but music that is played in films, which is not the same thing, of course, or music which I associate with a certain kind of architecture is sometimes the case, then it has much more staying power, or music that I associate with a particular period or typical set of events or so on, then I remember it. But I'm not in truth really that much of a musical person, and I find that I have less and less patience for it.
Yeah.
Unless it's things that I did like once before, but I don't go out and look for new ones.
No, and I'm in the same place as you in that sense. And you mentioned The Seekers, and it's interesting because Morning Town Ride was also the theme tune for Junior Choice, which is the program which is also a vestige from my past, which came back every Christmas, and it still occasionally does now with Ed Stewart, the late Ed Stewart. But it's having that music of that era, and I've watched the video many times, the pre-video video in those days of The Seekers, actually on a train and performing that, and Judith Durham, whose voice sounds just as good as it did, but she's obviously a lot older now, and she has had some health problems, but watching and listening to that sort of music and all the different associations, it's not just the 60s, which obviously I don't remember because I was born in 73, but it's almost as though the nostalgia for that age, which was from many years later, but then hearing generations of people who grew up in the 60s, who were maybe children at the time, who are now parents and grandparents or great-grandparents, who then associate it with particular music that they asked to be played. But because it's often Christmas morning only that you're going to hear some of this music, there is that. So then there's that association of Christmas and sacred time and nostalgia.
There's a bit of that, isn't there? Yeah. That is certainly true. I don't know what it is about Morning Town Ride. That's exactly what I was talking about to my friend on Monday, but it is doing something that we don't know what it is yet, I think. It's always important to bear in mind. You'll say this as a theologian, I would have thought that it's always important to bear in mind that we don't know that much. And that's what there is a lot to do with the emotional power of music that we haven't got a clue
But often in the sense, and I found this often with filmmakers that I've met, that sometimes it's best not to talk about what you have grasped from their film or the product that they've created, because, and it happened in my case when I met Thelma Schoonmaker, who's edited all of Scorsese's films since Raging Bull, and has a Canterbury connection. And I met her once, and I mentioned that I'd done a lot of work on Scorsese for my PhD and onwards. And perhaps I just assumed that she'd be very, very interested, but I think there was a look on her face like, oh, where is this going? And I guess maybe she's just not used to people coming up and talking on that sort of level. But it was very interesting that, we all have our little obsessions, and we often, particularly love the music or the films or the theology of a particular person. But then you meet the person who also might think, well, that's not necessarily how I conceived it, or it might just be, that was my job.
That's often the case with architecture historically, because architects tend not to be word people by and large. The number of people who are architects who could say what they were doing correctly is absolutely tiny. Vanbrugh was one, but very few people can. They're nearly always talking about their, by definition, of course, they can't talk about what the significance or the impact of what their work is, because it hasn't happened yet. So they can't do that. So what architects tend to do is they tend to latch on to the language of their period, and specifically onto the language of the people from whom they want the work, which I think is one reason why early 19th century Gothic Revival architects talked so much in the language of the church, because they were the clients that they want. And that happens, that repeats itself all over again in various periods. Architects who wanted to do public housing spoke like some kind of early sociologist very often, or they spoke like community politicians, if those were the jobs that they wanted. So there is a mismatch in any case in between the words and the object itself. It's very hard for people who are not architects to grasp that a building is a thing. Let me give you a very specific university-based example of this. The famous REF, the Research Excellence Framework. Now, writers will submit books or articles, of course, most academics do. But you can also submit artifacts, if that's what you are. Of course you can, because if you couldn't, then no university department that dealt with making things would be eligible. So you can. Now, what I was very struck by was that we submitted two buildings, one house and one group of buildings and urban master plans or plans to the REF, and what I found was that the senior managers further up in the REF process here could not grasp that the house was the thing. I was repeatedly asked, but where is the article about it? Where is the book? Where is the document? Because they couldn't see that it was the building was the actual thing, with all the references that it needed, without them being written down. Sometimes I wonder what architecture is doing in universities, because it's very different in many ways. It's clearly a vocational course, and it needs to be. And I think the answer is probably that it offers those who are studying architecture a big opportunity to get involved in other things, which indirectly or sometimes directly will be helpful to them in their architectural education. Yeah. But it's very striking that it's not the language that really helps. And the language is often used for buildings can sometimes be quite dumb. I was an architecture student at a really bad time in architectural education, I think probably the nadir of it, when no imagination of any kind was permitted, and only a very narrow type of interpretation of what buildings should look like and why they look like what they do. This began to break up in the 1980s with the arrival of postmodernism in architecture, which is not really, it has got something in common with postmodernism in general, but postmodernism in architecture did begin to represent a movement away from that, because there the architects and indeed the people writing about these buildings were starting to draw on a big range of different sources and experiences, and not simply the entirely linear modernist interpretation of design, which had stifled so much. As architecture began to develop in what essentially is a postmodernist way, architectural education stayed exactly where it had been in about 1958, as far as I can see, until very recently. So one thing I try to do in my own writing is I do try to give some reference to the personal experience of places, not because I think that anyone's individual experience is particularly significant, and certainly not mine for any reason, but because it's important to realise that architectural critiques do come from a personal experience. Yeah. So all it's doing really is explaining, saying explicitly, that this is the case, and that there isn't any point necessarily in trying to look at these things objectively, because there isn't any especially objective attitude to take.
Yeah, and I was thinking the degree to which all research is autobiographical. I think that's also why I was keen to study nostalgia, and I say study it in the sense of making an academic project out of it, because it was something that I was already doing, but it was in a various convergences. But I was just talking to one of my undergraduate students this morning who's doing a joint honours degree in French and religious studies, and he is so passionate about a dissertation because no one else could do the dissertation he's doing, looking at French cinema, looking at the relationship between religion and the secular in France. But he has a very unique vantage point because he spent a year in France, he's doing French and religious studies. I think he's the only student doing that particular combination. And it just made me think that this sort of notion of, you know, if there's something that gets us up at 7 in the morning or whatever time we get up, what is it that makes us do what we do? What is that passion? Where does it come from? What is the, and we use the word of, you know, you mentioned the REF, impact is a big thing here, but the impact on the individual. And I think that I hear many people talk about their research and the impact that it has, but I often think that's all well and good. But just as with my students, I sometimes want them to know what makes me tick, so that they can say, there's a read that they can hold on to and say, okay, we know where he's coming from, so we can situate ourselves in the context of what Chris is delivering. I think it's the same with everything that we do. Sometimes we do it implicitly. Sometimes we perhaps just assume that there is some impact of what we do. Or sometimes we are a bit inscrutable, and sometimes we think, but you're doing a wonderful project, but what makes you do it? What is your unique voice in that? And it sounds as though what you're doing comes out in spades.
Well, I myself never think about what I'm doing, and I just go on doing it. I think I'm like, didn't Descartes say that the dog was like a collection of springs or something? Yeah. It didn't have any. I think I'm one of those. I'm a collection of springs in that sense. I get up and I do it, and I do it in a kind of, you know, driven Presbyterian way, that it's part of your duty in life is to go on working.
Yeah.
So I certainly do that, but that accounts for the mechanics of it, I suppose, but it doesn't account for where the ideas come from.
Yeah.
It is true that once it became obvious to me how much of it is based on versions of nostalgia, then I began to see where to go next. Yeah. But now I'm not entirely sure where where the idea for my most recent project came from. It must have been at the back of my mind somewhere, I suppose. Funnily enough, here's a story about how memory misleads you. I wrote a piece for the Architectural Association Files a few years back about Sir Terry Farrell's house, which was designed by Edwin Lutyens, which is called Great Maytham Hall outside Rolvenden. And I sent it in to the editor, it was an extremely good editor called Thomas Weaver, and he said to me, it's not funny enough, I think is what he said, or it's not interesting enough. So I had a go at making it funnier, and I appended to the beginning a story which of a school trip to the Scilly Isles, so this would have been about 1977, and in my story, what happened was, the reason why I thought of appending this particular story was that one of the people on that trip was a friend of mine from school called Nick Service, and Nick's father was the great historian of Edwardian architecture until he died, I think, about 10 years ago or so. So that was going to be the connection. And I told a story about how Nick and I rushed down to get the last boat back onto St. Mary's from Tresco, I think we were on, how we just made it in time and so on. Then I thought, once this came out, I thought, well, I better actually find Nick and ask him what he thinks about my having told this story about us. And he said, well, that's a very enjoyable story, but it never happened because I wasn't able to go on that trip because I think he said he twisted his ankle or something. So the whole thing was be completely falsely remembered.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me that it was falsely remembered because I don't really remember anything very much, but it did surprise me that a story that was falsely remembered could have had such an impact that it shouldn't have had, because it would never happened.
But at the same time, when I see a film, and the Coen brothers played this, you know, to the hilt in Fargo, but when you see the caption at the beginning, this is based on it, or this is as it happened, this is a true event, and my heart sinks, because I think that what I want sometimes in a film is not the nuts and bolts, this is what happened. I mean, that's what my diary is for, I guess. But sometimes what I want is something to connect with me. And if it's going to really connect, then sometimes it's about the power of ideas and creativity. You know that the language is not going to be verbatim. I mean, this came up with my grandfather, who met my grandmother in 1941 in Cornwall. They were both in the Air Force, the WAF and the Royal Air Force, respectively. And what was fascinating is that my grandfather wrote 60, 70 years later his memories from that time, and he did it very conversationally. You know, he'd remember the conversations, or he'd present it in quotation marks. And my mum said, but you couldn't remember those words word for word. And of course I thought, well, that's not the point. But what he's remembering, he may not remember the words, but he remembers the context, and he's evoking a certain type of mood. And that's far more powerful than the, well, actually you got that word wrong, or there's no way that particular sentence was uttered at that particular time. And I think that's the crucial thing, is that sometimes we often identify, and it's back to what we were saying about music, particular things, particular moods. And it might be a particular record, I don't know, Van Morrison, anything like that, which we associate with a particular time and place. And that, in a way, is far more important. It's the mood of an era, far more important than, you know, swing the mood and all that.
Because you're an expert in this, you will have heard it. You would have heard the theory that you can only have nostalgia for shared experiences and not for individual ones. Do you think that's right?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, because it's that notion of corroboration, that do we need someone to authenticate a memory? Which is why also sometimes if you really enjoy a film or a piece of music, you want to share that. But if somebody then says, not my sort of thing, not really interested, you feel very wounded because you thought you had something in common with this person, that there's this shared identity. Or it's that whole sort of notion of, you know, going on reunions and meeting people who you thought you knew wonderfully, or you had all these things in common, and you realise, and it happens with family members as well sometimes, with siblings, you think, I have very little in common with you. And you're right, but it's that sense that, can you have a nostalgia without the wider tapestry.
Yeah, without the wider thing, yes.
And because otherwise it becomes something very solipsistic. And if you've lived a solipsistic life, then you probably have a solipsistic nostalgia. But if you're nostalgic for your school or your university years, then it would have to be shared by definition.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been nostalgic for anywhere other than those first places.
Yeah.
Certainly not for any institution. I certainly, you know, there have been periods when I've certainly enjoyed doing, I had very enjoyable work, for instance, in the late 80s, working for an architect called Philip Mercer. It was very useful and valuable, and all round it was an enjoyable experience. But I've never described anything of that as being nostalgia.
Yeah.
Didn't really like living in London, for one thing.
Yeah.
And again, the whole of the 1990s was actually a fantastic period for me, but I wouldn't say it's nostalgia. More pleasure in describing it in writing as if it was nostalgia than it actually being nostalgia.
Absolutely.
I would say.
And sometimes it's instinctive that sometimes you almost, I mean, I'll give an example. I saw The Third Man yesterday, the Carol Reed film. When I first saw it, the mistake I made was watching it on a bit illicit of me in those days, watching it was on like Channel 4 1:30 in the afternoon, or S4 Seymour most probably, and it was the wrong time and it was the wrong place, because I knew I had, maybe it should be doing other things. But I watched this, it was light outside, something just didn't connect. It was very dialogue driven. I missed the point of it. And I thought, but this is a classic, you know, why have I not connected? So I think I may even have read the Graham Greene novel at one point. But I saw it again yesterday in the right context, on the big screen, with an audience. And that changed my apprehension of the film. And that's what it comes down to. It's often the context, it's the time, it's the place. But also all sorts of associations. And also this notion as well, I think, of putting something right, correcting the past almost. Not changing the past,
but almost
then sort of having a sense in which everything then has a purpose.
Yes, that's right. And that's what I think architects are doing to some extent. And why certain periods of architectural history reoccur later on. You want to go back into it and make it happen again. That is what lay behind the type of architecture I've been researching recently of the Edwardian period, which was Tudor in the towns and Tudor in the countryside and Stuart in the towns, where Tudor was harder to get bylaw regulation approval. They devised a way of building which was as if there had been a continuous tradition without the dreaded 18th century in it.
Yeah.
I think they didn't really say this. Some of the most astute critics, the critic of country life, H. Avery Tipping, who was really the first serious architecture critic, I think, he saw what was going on and he more or less describes it in those terms. And his successor, Lawrence Weaver, does a bit. And those two were miles ahead of anybody else. In the rest of the architectural press, it was architects writing about architects and they couldn't see anything.
Absolutely. And a question, a very obvious question, is, well, what inspired you to enter academia? But that's the interesting thing, because, I mean, I guess in my case, I suppose, am I an academic, am I a theologian? Well, the two are fused.
Mm.
But in your case, would you consider yourself, you know, you're an academic architect or an architect who became an academic, or what sort of trajectory are you on?
Sometimes people say that doctors go on being doctors. Architects go on being architects primarily.
Yeah.
And sometimes the fit with academia is quite uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I say that, after all, as somebody with 100% architectural mentality, I would say, the 100% mentality of an architect. But no, the bits that I were good at were either the very small details of things or alternative, the exact opposite, large-scale master planning I did a lot of in Israel. I wasn't an enormously creative, I was a hopeless student. I wasn't really particularly creative as a designer. I was completely competent, but I wasn't anything other than that, really, I don't think. Whereas I was much better at teaching, I found.
Yeah.
So I did it because I was better, you know, it's my driven Protestant thing again.
Yeah.
You just have to go and do it because you're better at it. So that's it.
Yeah.
There's no room for discussion.
No,
here.
I think that's right. And I think that sometimes that we all have these drivers, and often they come from within. And it's not always the case. I mean, I always imagine sometimes that if I don't do a particular job, that's, you know, that there's someone who's going to tell me off. But I realise that actually it's just myself. You know, often you think it's a parent, or it might be a line manager, or it might be a friend, but it's often an authority figure. It's often an authority figure. And often it probably comes down to a particular experience you had in your primary school when, you know, if you were not paying attention, or you didn't answer the teacher, or you didn't remember your times tables, you might be disciplined in some way, or just humiliated anyway, in front of, which is the same thing, in front of all the other pupils. But often you're right. But you mentioned the Protestant work ethic. I mean, the role of, and I have to ask this as a theologian, but the role of religion and faith, has that been something quite formative for you?
No, I'm one of life's natural Protestants, but in fact, I mean, my father's family were Catholics. Yeah. What I would call quite extreme Catholics. My mother's family were agnostic, Sephardi Jew. Well, they weren't all Sephardi. Her mother's family were Ashkenazis, but they were, the Ashkenazi ones were liberal Jews, and the Sephardi ones, my mum's dad, were Sephardi heretics. So I see, like many people do as you get older, and more and more obvious how similar my personality is to my mum's, much more than my other brothers and sisters, the exception of one, but certainly my attitude to things is exactly hers, right, which was what you might call, I don't know what it was, rational, logical.
And didn't take you many years to see that, because I found that. No, I realised how similar I am to my parents.
I just never thought about it, that's what it was. I don't tend to think about abstract things, but I I come to the conclusion that I was brought up very well. And my mum had to go out to work anyway when my dad departed, so there was working, you know, from the beginning was what there was going on in the house, and everything arranged around it. And she put, as many parents do, enormously high premium on a high value on working hard at school. So I just did it. I just did it. Naturally, you know.
And one of the questions, as well as, it's often, you know, the politics question and the religious question are often the ones that, you know, I have to judge.
No, they're just the same in me. They're just exactly the same attitude. Well, church social democrat from day one. Yeah. Never changed.
And in your case, and of course, one of the questions that I often ask is, you know, can you remember the first time you voted in an election? But of course, in your case, you know, I've read the autobiography of your aunt.
So, yes, so there was a lot going around campaigning.
I did actually go
canvassing for the Labour Party in the 1979 general election in the Clackmannan constituency, where astonishingly the Labour Party won it from the SNP. So although that was an auspicious start, I wasn't quite old enough to vote in that election, which was in May, and my birthday was in July. The following general election was when I was doing what architecture students call the year out between the third and fourth years, and then I went canvassing for the SDP in Edinburgh, where we'd had a very good showing. I slightly felt that at university the first time round, I was a very uncomfortable student. I didn't like it at all. I didn't basically like being told what to do, I think is what it probably came down to. But I probably spent too much time in student politics as a first, when I did my degree, and so my first time round. So consequently, I slightly stayed clear of it, because it seemed to me that it just interfered with working. So I never really did anything much then. I went to UCL for what we call the part two, years four and five, and there I set up the University Social Democrats, and at that point I thought, I've now done my duty, and I'm not going to do any more. It's quite enough of that kind of thing.
But along the way, you must have met so many illustrious figures.
Shirley was great at taking us to things with her. She did when she was a minister. She did when she was setting up the SDP, and she did, and she continues to do so now. Oh, I see you have a book over there. Very good. I just noticed it just this minute.
Quite coincidental.
Yeah. Yes. She was great at us meeting people. But don't forget, I saw them as if they were exotic animals in a zoo, because I wasn't going to be a politician. So you could look at them. You have to be. There are two things that you need to even get started as a politician. One is you need enormous physical stamina, first of all. And second, you have to think really quickly. I certainly don't think quickly, and never did. It always takes me for quite a while to think of how to respond to anything, and I've learned that you shouldn't respond to anything complicated for a little while, for a bit. That doesn't mean I'm not good at make decisions quite quickly, actually. But in responses to things, a politician can't get it wrong, really. In addition to much else, she was brilliant at those two things. So you see a very effective politician at work, which is a useful education to have.
Yeah, because I always find that some people find this a strange sort of niche interest, but I always found that reading the autobiographies of politicians after they left office, when you then see what they thought about something which at the time they had to deny. I remember Jack Straw is a good example. You know, he was a bit more nuanced in his thinking about Gordon Brown, but at the time there were lots of rumours about, you know, whether he really thought that Gordon Brown was up to the job, even though he ran his campaign in 2007, just as he'd run Tony Blair's in, gosh, it would have been 94, wouldn't it? So it was very interesting to then read in the autobiography just a slightly more nuanced take on what was going on, because the sort of things you can't say if you're a cabinet minister, that's very clear. But of course, in the case of Shirley Williams, as somebody who I'm guessing, and I think I put this to you when the first time I met you, you know, if there is a book, isn't there, sort of, you know, about what would happen if Portillo had won his seat in London in 97, might he then have become, you know, Tory leader and prime minister, the sort of what if scenarios. And I guess if the 79 result had been different in Stevenage, I think, wasn't it?
Yes.
Then who knows? You may have ended up with, and this is just hypothetical, but you could have had a female leader of the opposition. I don't know if she would have wanted that.
I don't know if she really would have wanted to very much. She does have very specific interests. She was always, her interests mainly to economic, mainly, and also in international relations.
Yeah.
And those things for her were much more important than the great run of things that every prime minister has to be interested in or pretend to be interested in. Yeah. She certainly didn't want to be on the back benches in 79 with the Labour Party, as you will remember, fell in on itself. And it was a very nasty time for many mainstream Labour Party politicians at the time. And I think that with the benefit of however many years it is, hindsight now, 38, that they did the right thing, those people. Sometimes it's held up as a heroic failure and sometimes it's held up as a pathetic failure, depending on where people are in the current spectrum. But I think the people who founded the SDP, which incidentally, I hope you noticed, they did enormously efficiently compared to recent party foundings. It was done very thoroughly and very well. It was absolutely the right thing to do, and it had an enormous impact on what happened to the Labour Party later. Of course, the Labour Party later under Tony Blair ended up somewhere to the right of what the Social Democrats had been in
favour
of.
Yes, it did, and it was very clear as well that he owed so much to Roy Jenkins.
Yes,
as well.
Of course they did. Yes, they were all clever people. Those people. It's often said of Bill Rogers, for instance, that he's been always very underrated publicly for his political skills and for his intellect. I think that's absolutely right. Actually, I think he was a really important figure in that group.
And I grew up, as I remember, that I was only nine. I think the general election might have been on my birthday.
Oh yes,
9th of June in 1983. We could somebody can check this out afterwards, but. And I remember all the party political broadcasts. I remember in the schools, we're only 9 or 10, but we were all talking, you know, are your parents voting Labour, SNP or Conservative? And I lived in what turned out, I think, George Thomas's seat, pretty sure, Cardiff West. Again, really before my time. But when he then stood down after his speakership ended, and it was a very marginal, it wasn't marginal because he'd held it, of course, as Speaker, it was obviously not, it was not contested. But the Conservatives won, Stefan Teleski, there we are, 1983, and it was because of the SNP and the Labour vote was very much split. And then Roger Morgan, who went on to become First Minister in Wales, won the seat back for Labour in 87. But these were times when there was so much fervour in a way that kind of stopped for many years, certainly in the years after Tony Blair, something I found here at this university. Students were never really super enthusiastic about voting in elections. That changed in 2017 and what happened in Canterbury, of course, and, you know, went Labour for the first time in 100 years. But very interesting that this is what everybody was talking about. So it's very odd in that sense, and to be meeting you and sort of obviously having, you know, one of the members of the Gang of Four as a close relative. But we were very excited that these were things that mattered to us. It mattered what people put in the windows of their homes or the businesses and say who they were going to vote.
It mattered a huge amount when I was a student,
which
was a long time because I was an architect. So 79 to 85. It then mattered enormously, and student politics mattered enormously. Now, student politics then became basically a competition to see who could be the most sanctimonious, as far as I can see. Yeah. And then in places like this, it doesn't really exist in politically at all, does it? It's not party political in it. Yeah. But even in Cambridge, the student union was highly politicised along party lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people took it enormously seriously.
Yeah. And a few more philosophically based questions, just as we start to round off. Would you say, Timothy, your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey the whole of your life and career?
Yeah, I don't think I don't think back much, and when I do, it tends to be to a very small range of events. Yeah. You can see this is a continuous theme. The small number of buildings are enormously influential. A very small number of films and of books are enormously influential. Yeah. Same thing is true of memories. A small number are, but I don't tend to. I don't, on the whole, tend to look back at anything very much, and certainly not particularly inquisitively either, I have to say. I don't think that's very good, is it? But it's the case.
But what about but can you be nostalgic, do you think, though, about negative experiences? In other words, are there things from the past?
I tend to forget them. They get eradicated or back off to what you were saying,
yeah, but that's the thing, isn't it? It's about going back over, and you can't change what happened, but you can change the interpretation, or in some ways correct, maybe, deficiencies.
Yeah, you can try to correct them, that's true.
Yeah.
Yes, you can, but I don't know whether I do that consciously. I probably do it subconsciously.
Yeah.
It's probably possible to interpret the things that I write about as being a way of correcting, but it's very hard for the person themselves to see that they're doing it consciously.
And what do you think your younger self would think about what you're doing now? I mean, I guess it works both ways. What advice would you give to your, say, your 15-year-old self?
Yes, it's always an interesting question, isn't it? There's only ever one thing that I think that's ever worth part. The only useful piece of information I ever heard was that you should, if you find a teacher that you learn a lot from, then you try and get as much out of them as you possibly can. Now, that is certainly something where I wasn't that bad at it, but I'll give you a very straightforward example of that. I said earlier that we were architecture students at the worst possible period, and the general attitude of us towards the people teaching us and vice versa was apathy, I think. It was very uninteresting is the main thing said about it, which is astonishing given the great richness of architectural history and of continuing architectural traditions of various kinds. It's astonishing. In my last... it's not quite nostalgia, this is. I don't know what it is. But in my last term, in that last summer term, which would have been 1982, horrible year, 1982, there was a youngish chap had come back in to do a bit of extra teaching at Cambridge, and his name was Peter Blundell-Jones, and he showed genuine... I was writing about Pugin's houses, basically, and Peter showed genuine interest and enthusiasm in it, and he showed it like a proper teacher does. That's to say, he could ask direct, sharp questions to make me think better about what it was that I thought was interesting about what I was doing. Now, I saw Peter probably twice, and I think that was it probably. But I remembered it like anything, because it was probably the most uplifting couple of hours that I spent at that place. Because uplifting was definitely what the rest of it wasn't, and. Peter went on to become extremely distinguished architecture historian and he was already by then an architecture historian and teacher. He was professor at Sheffield, mostly, and he died a little while back. He died comparatively young age, but he was a fabulous teacher, and many, many people came to attest that when they held in a memorial event at the University of Sheffield a little while back. The only message worth having, do you remember that Ian Forster says, there's only one message worth giving, but it wasn't this one. The only message worth giving, I think, is that when you find someone from whom you can learn a lot, you should just learn whenever you can. It's generally true in other applications. My boss, Philip Mercer, in the late 1980s used to say, if you find a really good tradesman, a joiner, a carpenter, a plumber, whatever it is, then you just want to ask them to do everything you can possibly think of, because the following year they might, you know, break their arm or emigrate to Spain or any other number of things could happen. Get the most out of it. When you come across quality of any kind, get everything you possibly can out of it. But it's really important in the case of teachers, I think. Yeah. And that is directly the thing that I say to my own students. If you find somebody here that you get on well with, then just keep on going back. Because by and large, as we know, students, we don't like to be bothered unnecessarily, but we like very much to be bothered by people who are interested in learning things.
No, and I used to find that, you know, at school sometimes you'd see your teachers as a sage. You know, they may not be experts in their field, but they seem to be. When you're 17 years old or 7 years old, if your teacher is telling you something that you didn't know before, well, they are the authority. And then you go to university sometimes and then meet the people who've written all these books, but then find that they may be world-renowned in this area, that area, but not exactly. The subject you think, but hang on a minute, my teacher at school could give me a direct answer to the question. Here, they're not. Yeah, they're not giving me that.
Actually, I think I was lucky at school because the standard of teaching at my school was an awful lot higher than it was at university. Yeah. It was a considerable jump down, and there were some people still teaching who should maybe have retired several decades beforehand. But there were enough very good teachers at my secondary school, and it was really quite astonishing to go to a place where almost nobody seemed able to do it. But Peter Bundle-Jones really stood out, and he wrote beautifully. He was a great model for anybody wanting to see how to write clearly and well and in a kind of enticing and friendly way about something. It was very sad when he died, but he had done a hell of a lot of good work in his life.
Yeah. And are you in touch with many friends from your past?
No. Am I? Let me think. I have one, I do have a school friend who I'm still in touch with, and have been continuously, who is a writer and a biographer, and is also the co-literary executor. This is Mark Bostridge, also the co-literary executor of the Vera Brittain Estate. So we have business to discuss regularly, but he has gone on being a very loyal friend all this time. Yeah. Is there anyone else from school? Well, I mentioned Nick Service earlier, and I am back in touch with the Service family now because I've been writing on the subject which established their father as a great historian. Yeah. From university, again, I come across people occasionally. There is somebody who was at school with me, who was perfectly friendly with at the time, who then went on with me to be an architecture student, who has reappeared as a mature PhD student in my own department here. So that's quite odd.
Yeah.
And very nice. And it seems to me that she hasn't changed at all. It's great.
Yeah.
But no, not much. Yeah. With some obvious exceptions, I tend to have friends, you know, for the time and place that I'm at.
Yeah, no, I found it was, I went to my old university reunion in the summer, and we were all saying to each other, oh, you haven't changed a bit.
Mm.
And then I showed my own sister, who was also at the same university, she's 3 years older than me, but we overlapped, and I said, you're never going to guess who I saw, and I showed her the pictures, and she was like, well, the name's a little bit familiar, but I thought, but they look just the same, and, well, of course, to me they look the same, but maybe not to her, or maybe it's just that, you know, she has a different sense of memory.
I always think people look the same, I say.
But my very last question, Timothy, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Well, now, I think I have quite short term in either direction. I don't look much further, apart from nervous things like what happens about your pension and so on. I don't have any problem about long term planning of that kind. I don't much look forward, and I probably should have done more when I was younger and didn't. I didn't have any concept of future time when I was younger, and I still don't much, but it was a shame that I didn't. Things might have been a bit more organised. Do I look back? Well, I look back through my writing. But I long ago realised that the style in which one writes is not necessarily a reflection of your personality. It's a skill, it's a technical skill. I mentioned earlier that Thomas Weaver asked me to make the article on Great Maytham funny. Well, I wasn't in a mood for writing anything funny at the time, I can tell you. But you realise that it isn't to do with what mood you're in or how reflective you're feeling. It's a technical skill.
And, of course, comedy can come from a very dark place.
Well, that is also true. But that, in this case, that part wasn't so much relevant. It was more a technical job, which is that you have to make a funny... I mean, I don't think you necessarily write in a more funny way when you're in a good mood, actually. Writing is a technical skill. And if you have enough practice at it... I wrote a lot when I was young. I used to write novels when I was young. I went on doing it for a long time. None of them were any good, but I'm glad I did it because it was very good practice. So
have you still got those novels? Did you keep them
somewhere around?
Yeah,
probably.
Has anyone ever read them?
No, I don't ever reread. I don't write things that I've written myself.
So nobody else has read the novels? So they're very much
yours? What happened was, I actually got, when I sent out a couple of them to publishers, I tended to, on the whole, to get quite good responses, but then obviously I was not good enough. But I came to get responses, said, we think this is very good, very interesting, but we can't do it just now, that kind of response. Yeah. So that was something. They weren't saying this is rubbish, take it away, or not replying at all. Those were the kind of responses that I was getting. So therefore, you know, I wrote another one and so on. And in the end, I started to write non-fiction things, which got published. But I needed that experience of writing. I needed to have gone through all those processes. That's how you learn how to do things. Also, of course, reading very good writers. I belong to a distinct strand of British architectural history writing, which essentially comes from the great Mark Girouard. Now, the great Mark Girouard wrote about, he was the architectural editor of Country Life for a long period, and wrote about, his best known books are about country houses, but that's by no means his expert, all his expertise. He's written a lot, in particular, about Elizabethan architecture, fabulous book, actually, about Elizabethan architecture a few years back. And this is wonderful writing. It's clear and it's direct, and it manages to be personal without being intrusive. And what it does more than anything else is that it tells a story. My own doctoral supervisor, I didn't do a PhD till I was 40-something, my own doctoral supervisor is Andrew Saint, who has remained a great friend ever since. And Andrew is 15 years older than me and 15 years younger than Mark Girouard. And Andrew also comes out of this tradition, and Andrew was always saying about buildings, about writing about buildings, that there isn't any point in doing it unless you're telling an interesting story that people might want to know. And that really is Mark's whole creation, all that field of stuff. It's enormously impressive, and he does it still, writes absolutely fabulously, I think. It is a, you know, it's a distinct group to be part of. It's probably the only actual group of anything that I am really part of.
Timothy, this has been such a wonderful, we've covered everything,
I think, this afternoon. Yes, we talked a lot,
wonderful to catch up. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much.